Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by sportsshoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways, and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. What an episode we have today. We've got none other than Zane Robertson. The guy needs no introduction, but look, he's a two-time Olympian. He's a Commonwealth Games bronze medalist. Just let the guy do the talking. Enjoy.
An incredible episode. Lam, as you mentioned, Zane Robertson on this week. Pleasure to record with him. Fascinating story. But I also want to give a special shout out to Miles Edwards. He kind of put us in touch, hooked us up. So Miles, if you're listening, mate, thank you very much. Happy New Year and a Merry Christmas to you, buddy. All right. Yeah, on the topic of Christmas, it's not that Christmas theme. That is a very inspiring story. So maybe it's going to inspire you to set some New Year's goals, maybe do the things that you've always wanted to do, but you haven't got around to yet. But look, if you haven't heard Zane's story, I'm not going to spoil it in the intro. Just listen, because it is kind of jaw-dropping and it's something which hits home to me. You know, growing up as a teen, I first caught wind of like Zane and Jake Robertson, and I was like, wow, I wish I had the courage and the bottle to do what these guys done. If you have heard their story like I had, you're going to want to listen to it, because you haven't heard it in this light with this much background, detail and context as Zane tells it, you know, very much from his own words. So all round a cracking episode. And, you know, Zane has lived his professional career. We often get a lot of Europeans and Americans on, obviously, and we get an insight into their professional career. He's, even though he's from New Zealand, you would maybe put him in the same bracket as us. The way he's lived has been very much Kenyan, and his struggles of his career have been the same struggles a Kenyan athlete would have when it comes to, you know, shoe contracts or management, getting into races. So his pathway has been very similar to a Kenyan athlete. He's been almost treated like one as well. So we kind of get a really good insight into how it all works, you know, in Kenya and Ethiopia. So that was kind of a good take home for me. But look, I won't ramble too much longer. Enjoy the podcast. I can't believe it's a week till Christmas. So stay safe, keep it merry, have a drink, and we'll catch you next week. As always, take care.
Right. First off, Zane, just welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on, mate.
Yeah, good pleasure to be here.
Yeah, obviously, like your running story for yourself and your brother has been kind of quite well documented already, but we just want to start from the beginning, really. Could you talk us through like your upbringing in New Zealand and how you actually first got into the sport in the first place?
Oh, yeah. Interesting story. It started all the way back in kindergarten. We used to have races just out the back of the kindergarten, and Jake and I, we're quite fast. We just whooped the other kids. Going on to primary school, our mum bought us those Roman sandals. So we went from being like king shit to absolutely last. And we hated that feeling, couldn't work out why. And, you know, one day I took the sandals off and I ended up winning by really quite a long way. Jake, he kept the sandals on, was like towards the back again, but I just told him, hey man, if you take the sandals off, you don't feel the prickles, just run faster. And that's what he did. Next day, both of us kicked everyone's ass, and it kind of went like that into intermediate school as well and high school. I think the intermediate, as soon as we hit the 11 and 12 age group, our first year, we did well. We won in our school, but as soon as it went into schools, we got absolutely destroyed, and we hated that feeling because all the other kids had started training and we were late developers. We were a bit skinny. And so the next year I put in some work. I started training a little bit and I ended up winning the interschools by a long way. And the same exact thing happened in high school. People were training more seriously. We did well. We won our school competition, but as soon as it went to the deeper event, we got our asses kicked. And that was the year where our mum told us, boys, maybe it's time you focus on schoolwork. And not knowing our character, you know, when we get beaten, we absolutely come back with a vengeance. It's always been that way. So I think still to this day, I always have something left to prove. If I'm down, I'm at my most dangerous.
I mean, what's fascinating there is even it sounds like even from a very young age, you were just committed to running. Why so? What was it about running? Like, there must have been other sports in New Zealand as well. But
man, we were playing all the other sports at the same time. We loved basketball.
Yeah.
We were skateboarding, jumping downstairs, breaking our wrists and shit, break dancing. Oh man, we went through the works. Football, football as well. So we were playing all the sports, but I think we were addicted to competition. Being a twin, you grow up with someone who's like very close to you, and I think it's like, you don't want to be beaten by him and he doesn't want to be beaten by you. So it just gives you that competitive drive. And I think it gives you that edge later on in life. Like when you're doing something seriously, you won't stop until you win.
Good point. On that competitive edge, there's been rumors about a sauna off, if you can call it that, between the two of you, or a plank off as well. Just talk us through this story.
Oh shit. So Miles dropped us and
Miles may have mentioned something. Yeah,
he gave a little bit of information then. Well, yeah, you know, you get bored out in Kenya sometimes and you have to make good competition with your mates around the world. So we started this group on Facebook and we called it the HTBZ Brothers. It's kind of like whatever you call it, university fraternity or something like that. And we just start some competitions like planking as long as you can. You're allowed to change every 1 minute, but from side to middle to side. But
okay,
it got quite competitive because we had some physios in the group as well that could go up to an hour 10. Gosh. And I think, you know, eventually me and Jake, we hit like an hour 30, an hour 39 or something. It turned out that I was in Ethiopia going the same exact time as him. And I posted mine about 30 seconds before him. And we didn't know. I did like an hour 37. I think Jake did an hour 35.
Oh, my Lord.
And yeah, it was getting into a ridiculous point. And I got hurt. I got injured from running. So I just decided that on one day, I'll challenge two records at once. I'll do the plank record and I'll break the 2 hour mark. And on the same day, I'll break my chapati record, which was the group's record as well. So I broke 21 chapati in the evening. It was 23. And I did 2 hours, 1 minute, something seconds, I think 59 seconds on, on the plank.
Wow, you're a true freak. that's incredible.
It comes back down to that competition thing, yeah. Right? You just love competition. You love pushing yourself to that limit.
How do you train for a plank that long?
Man, you put some good music on and you kind of zone out.
Wow.
I think the first 30 minutes is the worst of it. Once you get used to 30 minutes, then you're away.
Okay.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah.
Well, look, you guys, you're kind of famous for trailblazing and kind of setting new possibilities. Obviously, for people who don't know, can you talk us through like how you obviously moved to Kenya, age 17, I believe, from New Zealand with your brother. And like, look, when you moved, you kind of went there and said, we're just going to live there. You're not going back to New Zealand.
Yeah, so the idea was born in 2006. World Cross Country, Jake made the junior team and he went out there to race in Japan. The Kenyan team was sharing the same floor as the New Zealand team. So we had some Somali friends and one of them was actually in the New Zealand team as well. So Jake started kicking it with the Kenyans and he met some of like our idols at the time, Augustin Chogi, Saif Said Shaheen, Benjamin Limo. And, you know, he asked the questions like, hey, if we come out to train in Kenya, would you like help us out, show us around a little bit? Just, and all the guys were super friendly. They're like, yeah, yeah, just come out. We'll help you. It's not dangerous. There's nothing there. You know, back in that time, there were no such things like the foreign training camps that are boosted now. Mm-hmm. So we were coming out to like the unknown, really. So 2006 in November, we packed our bags. Eventually, with the reluctant support of our mom and dad, our coach, everyone else just thought we were out of our minds, nuts. But they could see that we were going to go with or without them. So it's better we go with their support.
Mm.
And took a flight. We stayed in Ethiopia for 1 month with a friend from New Zealand, Ethiopian born, just to, I don't know, just for our parents' mind's sake, you know, they thought it was safe for their safety. And then boarding the flight to Nairobi before the new year, we really realized, oh shit, we're really in it now. There's no email, no phone numbers that Jake had got. And we just landed in Nairobi. We knew the names of the places. We'd done our study, done our homework, took a bus, which took about 8 hours to get to Eldoret City. And we got to Eldoret around 1 a.m. Just walked the street till we saw the nearest hotel and stayed a few hours and then got a, what you call a matatu, out to Kaptagat in the morning. We got lucky. We stopped on the side of the road and the first runner we saw passing by turned out to be Benjamin Limo's nephew and took us straight to the running camp. So we rolled up there and the guys were about to start a hill work session and we just jumped straight in. And yeah, I guess that's the real beginning.
Yeah. For people who don't know, like that is what, you know, you and your brother are almost famous for, that just absolute leap of faith. And you touched on it then in 2006, like you say, there was no smartphones. And especially not in Kenya, was there like sort of Wi-Fi? There wouldn't have been Wi-Fi or anything up there, would there?
Yeah, there were only internet cafes in town, which like Eldoret City, and you just go up there and work off a computer, and hopefully there'd be no power cut, which would destroy your email you spend 30 minutes writing.
So obviously you went out there and talk us through sort of why and what your plan was and you were hoping to get from it.
Yeah, that good point actually, because yeah, people don't understand that we did have a return ticket and the goals were Jake was already qualified for the World Cross in Mombasa in 2007 March. I was a 1500 runner back then, so I had to run 10k on track to qualify, which made no sense to me, so I didn't even attempt to qualify for the junior team. But our plan was to run the Jake to run the cross and then for us to build up before the European track season and hopefully go and try and run a race or two, but just basically get the experience. Somewhere deep in our own minds, we knew that we weren't coming back. We were like bent on this goal. Like we had I don't think we had one single supporter who thought we will actually come out alive or make it to the big time. Mm. And that just pissed us off. It just meant like, okay, go hard or just die out here, because at least we'll die knowing we tried everything we could. And after the World Cross Country in Mombasa, Jake did quite well in the heat.
Mm.
He came back to Iten. We'd moved from Kaptagat to Iten by that time. And Shaheen was taking care of us with his paces.
Wow.
And I decided that I'd try and run my first track race in Kenya. Shaheen secretly told the guys, the paces, that I don't think he's ready. He shouldn't do it. Mm. I didn't give a shit. I went ahead and went for it anyway. And, you know, how races go in Kenya, everyone goes out at world record schedule on a dirt track, mental. So there were 21 heats that day of 1500 meters, 21 heats.
Oh.
I was something like heat four. And I was also wearing the Qatar vest and gear from what Jake got in 2006 World Cross Country. So just to maybe embarrass Shaheen more, and he was in the crowd with his voice. I started the first lap in last place. There was a guy with training shoes and bare feet in front of me.
Yeah.
Coming around 800 meters, I was in the middle of the field. And then once we got to the last lap, I was actually coming through a lot of people. I started my kick down with 300 to go. And I remember the commentary to this day. The commentator was losing his shit. Mzungu Tuwende, Mzungu Tuwende. Which is like, white man go. Let's go. All right.
Yeah.
And I ended up kicking myself into fourth place in the last 50 meters, and I got fourth. Wow. I broke 4 minutes. I ran, I think it was 3:54.
Hmm.
And for like 17-year-old at altitude,
it's good, in his first
3 or 4 months there. It's not so bad on a dirt track.
Yeah.
But it did say that, like, you know, you're going in the right direction. Just don't lose hope.
I can't not touch upon it. Like, Shaheen, obviously, people who don't know, he's a world record over 3,000 meters steeplechase, isn't he? So you went out there and you kind of hit the jackpot and was under his guidance.
Yeah. And I got stories after the race from the pacemakers. They came to me and they said he was absolutely losing it. He couldn't stop laughing. Every lap I was passing some people and I was getting better and better. So I think deep down he was really proud, but
yeah,
to see where we've landed today, whenever I meet him, he's just like, he's super proud of where we've wow. landed.
Yeah, what was he like as a almost mentor, and could you call him your coach through a period of time?
Yeah, I think I call him my Kenyan father. Like,
wow,
he had so much wisdom, guidance. He cared for us more than a lot of people, and it was just genuine. Mm. He took us in. He took care of us to a point. He actually let us suffer quite a lot of the time, because he knew that if you just give people something, then they don't have that hunger anymore to make it for themselves, you know.
Mm.
He'll give you something to a point, like help, assistance in the right direction. He used to tell us, don't train with me every day because I will absolutely kill you. You know, you guys are 17, 18 years old mm. now, and I'm like a world record holder.
Yeah.
So actually the coach of Patrick Singh sort of told us, the coach of Eliud Kipchoge, mm. Patrick Singh, told us the same thing. He said, you can't train the same level as my best athlete who's 36 years old now.
Mm.
Just on the low. And that was back in 2010. So mm. if you put two and two together there, you work something out, but I can't say anything more. Yeah.
What's like kind of a typical day in your life in Kenya like back then? So kind of, I guess maybe in the first 6 months when you moved out there, what did you do on a day-to-day basis?
Hey, we were still on our, I just say our mental era. Like, you know, the maturity hadn't hit us yet. And also gaining all the knowledge that we have over the years. Say we would wake up at 5:45 and just go out the door for a training immediately. Like by 6 a.m. we're on the road, go for a run with Shaheen or his group. Other days, same thing, but without him.
Mm.
Then come back home, tea and bread for breakfast. Then by either like 9 or 10 a.m., we'd be walking up to the gym to do our first gym session of the day, followed by a second run. And then in the evening, run again, third time. Tuesday's track day. So morning, 5 a.m., wake up, run 30 minutes, then 9 a.m., warm up, track session. Evening again, third run. So this is not so smart, but it's going through the motion of like suffering and creating the bodies that we had when we have now to tolerate, I guess, the hard training we do.
Yeah. How long did it take you when you were out there to sort of adjust to the lifestyle, to the culture, to the diet?
Man, I don't think I ever have. And yeah, don't try that last topic at home, kids. Do not try that. To this day, I don't like ugali. I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
I love chapati, but that's technically Indian, isn't it? I do a lot of cooking myself at home in the weekdays, weekends. You know, we work so hard through the week. I always say just not even a cheat day, cheat days.
Yeah.
Saturday, Sunday, man, I just do whatever I like. I go to town.
Yeah.
I have my Indian, I have my pizza, I have my milkshakes. Man, quite surprisingly, the athletes, the really top guys, they sometimes love to drink too. So
yeah.
I just like to buy some bottles and have it at home. Turn my house into a club.
You pay for entry.
Oh man, I wish, man. But normally, the guys, I just like to shout them after a good week or something.
Yeah.
I hope I'll get the favor returned one day.
Is that why they call you Elvis?
Man, could be. Could be.
Yeah, no, because the only reason I touch upon that is I think I remember like FlowTrack maybe documenting it back in the day. And, you know, when you first went out there, you and your brother am I right in saying you got quite ill, quite sick for a period of time?
Oh, yeah. Good topic again. That was beginning in Kaptagat when we spent the first 1.5 months there. So Benjamin Limo's camp was completely full, people sharing mattresses, not a good place to move in. Mm-hmm. We went down the road to the global camp where Kipchoge was staying. And again, they were having some management issues at that time. He told us to meet with Patrick Singh, the coach who could advise us. And Patrick told us to move to Kaptagat Hotel so we could train with the group. And we did that for one night. And the next day, Benjamin Limo's nephew with two other athletes were coming to the hotel and just telling us to move in with them. And the camp that we moved into was self-funded by the athletes. So not doing really well, kind of struggling. But it was the old rundown Dr. Rosa camp, which at that time was just owned by it was owned by Moses Tanui, Boston champion, former champion in the track himself. But he had nothing to do with it at all. He just let the athletes come and train there and stay.
Right.
So we were kind of struggling with food and eating like they do. And we went through that whole process. they would cook with the real solid local cooking fat. We were cooking on a fire. It was fun. We were going going out after evening trainings to hack down trees with machetes so we could cook. And Jake and I, our naive, really naive behavior, I guess, we were pulling water from the water hole, which is like maybe 10, 12 meters down. And we were just pouring it straight to our bottles and drinking that shit. And we didn't realize for about a month. But one day, one of our friends came to us and just asked us, like, oh, you got some water. Can we drink water? I said, no, just go and get it yourself. They're like, where did you get it from? We told them the water hole. And they asked, did you boil it? And they, no. So they picked up the bottle. And for the first time, we actually looked what we're drinking. And there was dirt and pieces of grass and other shit floating around in the bottom of the bottle. And it definitely wasn't clear, but we'd never looked at it in the light. So they told us that about 2 or 3 months before we came, there was a baby cow that fell down there and died as well. And thinking about it, I now remember back to going out on runs, and within like 10 seconds of having like ultimate pain in your stomach, you would just either be off the road shitting, or you just wouldn't be, and you'd shit in your pants. A terrible experience, but amazing story to live and tell the tale.
Good Lord.
Look, obviously kind of going through like stuff like that, obviously you had your brother. Could you have done it alone, do you think?
Man, no way. I mean, there were frustrations to the point of, you know, like you said, did I ever get used to the culture and the differences and everything? No. Still till now, there's a lot of things. I suffer sometimes a little bit of depression because of it. And I think the only thing that keeps me going is like, I mean, back then it was Jake. Now it's the people that are really close to me here. I do have some good ones, but it took a long time to find them. We used to share that mattress together when we moved in with Shaheen's place. And we used to have 1 hour a night where we'd just talk to each other and called it seeing through the world. And we'd just talk shit about the day and what people have done to us or what that means, or trying to understand the way people think, because it's not the way it is now. Iten used to be like dirt roads everywhere, complete village. People weren't used to seeing white men who didn't understand our culture or where we came from, and how just being friendly on the street didn't mean something indirect.
Yeah, that must have been a weird experience for someone like yourself when you go into an environment where, yeah, they don't understand you and they don't understand our culture.
Yeah, man.
But like, looking back, was there times where you sort of, you were having these chats and you were thinking, mate, it's time to go. Like, what are we doing here?
There was like a moment or two where we would always think, did we make a mistake not going to the US? Because we saw like people around our age group who went out there and were getting gear, training facilities, and they were doing so well already. And, you know, once we'd stepped foot in this direction, we were like, no way we're turning back, because everyone at home will just say you're a failure. And, that they were right. And, you know, the tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand is huge.
Right.
We were just going to ride it out to the death. Like, we were bent on it, like absolutely bent on it. And I think putting ourselves in that situation where failure is death and there is no option but to succeed, that's exactly what the Kenyans have. And I think that's why a load of them are successful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. And then talking of success, When did you guys start to, you know, really, really see it? You said, like, he obviously went to, your brother went to the World Cross and stuff. Then you started appearing on the senior ranks and breaking through. And what did that look like and feel like for you guys?
I think the first race, the first documented race that we ran overseas, was the 2010,
it was about two or three years after you actually went out.
Yeah, it was it was 3 years on or something.
Wow.
It was this race, and there was a road race through a castle, and you can still find it on YouTube, I think. But there was a load of athletes like Kipchoge, Mayo at that time, Shaheen was there. There was the world junior 10K champion, which is now our brother-in-law. There were a load of athletes, loaded field, and Jake ended up out sprinting Shaheen in the last like 10 meters before the line.
Wow.
I ended up beating the 10K junior world champion at that year. So it was like already raising eyebrows, like, oh, who are these guys? The following year, unfortunately, we didn't get any track races, like none. Our management that time, who had picked us up in Kenya, was bent on us going to run half marathon and marathon. And
right.
I think we were still 19, 20 years old. and he didn't quite understand that the Kenyan's passport age is not the real age, and that we are too young to do that.
Yeah.
But I was lucky enough to get a 1500 on the track in Morocco, and I absolutely destroyed my PB. I ran a 341, and it was 41 degrees. And Jake, he didn't get any track race, but he did get a 10K road race in Prague, and he ran 28:47 or something around there, and he was fourth in a sprint finish. And that got way more attention because it was in a European race, and it sort of raised eyebrows again. But the next year, that's when Jake qualified for the World Championships in a race in Nijmegen in Holland. And it was kind of when we started to make names for ourselves, like, oh, who are these Kiwi kids out from Kenya? That was the year of Daegu. I think it was 2011.
Yeah, it would have been.
I was sort of living in Jake's shadow for a few years, trying to run the 1500 and also moved to Ethiopia. So I was going through a lot of changes in environment and training group, working out what worked well for me. But actually, 2012, I came back to Kenya to train for the track. And Miles, your guy's mate, he was in the party van heading down to a place called Katali, where I knew I was ready to challenge, like, and do something good, but I didn't quite know until I got there. And I ran a 3:41. I'd equaled my PB on a dirt track at altitude.
Wow.
And that's when I realized that, holy shit, okay, this is going to be a good year, 2012.
Obviously then, talk us through 2012 then, because obviously a big year. And when it starts out like that, I guess, how hard is it for you to compute what that equates to sometimes? Because obviously if you're constantly training at altitude and on dirt tracks, you might not always know exactly what shape you're going to be in or capable of.
Yeah, so after the Daegu World Champs, Jake and I, we decided to change management. We'd met another friend out here from Canada, Reed Coolsat, and he'd sent us on way to an American management. So luckily, after that result in Katali, I did have track races on the horizon in the US. And we flew out to California, where I ran a mile in Mount Sac, one of the collegiate races. And I was very, very jet lagged. We'd wake up at 2 a.m. and we'd miss dinner. And we thought the race was on Saturday evening. And it turned out it was Friday evening. We'd been playing basketball all day down at the local court, just like out in the sun, absolutely smashed. And I ran a 356 mile, and I thought that was like pretty good. And I had a guy, a Canadian, Nate Brannan, tell me, oh, that's nothing. So a lot of people can do that, like straight after the race. And it kind of pissed me off. I was like, okay then. Yeah, I know, but I'm young and I've got more. So yeah, I think it was a week later, I ended up running a 336, 336, 51, 1500 meters in Stanford. And I mean, from 341 to 336 in one race is pretty good. And I remember that qualified me for the Olympics. So I was super fucking happy. I was like, okay, yeah, you're going to the Olympics. It was 3:37.0, the qualifying time. And 3 days after I'd run that time, the New Zealand Olympic Committee came out and said, you need to run under 3:36.50. So one split of a second, they kicked. One split. And they knew Jake was a world championship finalist for the 5,000 the year before. They knew he was doing well. They knew we were out in Kenya working our asses off. And the reason they told me was because we've had people in the past who didn't make the semis, who didn't do anything. So we made our standard harder. But why would you want to do that for like a young upcoming athlete with no experience who could now be 3-time Olympian?
A good point. Like, did you ever, because you were in Kenya, did your governing body ever sort of overlook you and prefer to, you know, pick someone else over you guys? Because you were based in Kenya. Or did...
In the beginning, we missed our last World Juniors on the track. Because even our manager said, hey, look, they're in Europe. They can drive over the border. We're in Czech Republic. The World Juniors in Poland. We just need you to confirm them on the team. They've run the times.
Yeah.
Just send them. No answer. Nothing. No answer. World Cross, the same thing. Same thing for Edinburgh. We weren't selected on the team. That was a long time back when there were different people in charge.
Yeah,
but then once Scott Goodman came in, the high performance director, he was like, who are these guys? Like, and they said, oh they're just out in Kenya though. And he said, well, exactly, they have the leading time in New Zealand. Like, who the fuck are they? So get on it. Like, do we support them? How can we help them to be better? And that's when things started to change a little bit. I mean, we don't obviously get a lot of support, like all the physio access, and because of where we are, but they do help when they can, and I'm hoping it continues, because the Olympics and COVID and everything was a shit show. But man, going, I guess I go back to that story from 2012, and you want to finish the year, don't you?
Yeah, please.
Oh man, so yeah, after missing the Olympic Games and struggling for a few years in the 1500, I decided that maybe it's time to try 5000 or 5K on the road or something. And there was that Ekiden relay in Japan for the national teams, and I ended up being selected to be a 5K leadoff runner, so the starting runner. And my competition was Thomas Longasiwa, the bronze medalist from the Olympics in London. Osaka as well on the leadoff lap. I whooped the shit out of them. I won way, and I remember wearing a Garmin, but I don't know why I wasn't looking at it. I was just telling myself, don't look at it, don't look at it. There's still like a long way to go. I thought there was like 500 meters to go. I turned the corner and there was like 50 meters to go. I was already leading by like 20 to 50 meters, but I decided to start my sprint a little bit late. And I ran a 13:29 on the road.
Wow.
And I thought, well, you had a lot left there. You finished feeling fresh.
Mm.
So let's try this event next year and see what's up.
Mm.
History's history, but 2013 5000 world championship finalist, and you know the rest.
Sure, like
we do.
Obviously, these things, like, you kind of, the way you talk, they all come from setbacks, kind of people not believing in you. Do you think that's what has helped you most in your career, almost like having people like change the standard or say they don't believe in you going to Kenya? Do you think that's what's kind of made you the athlete you are today?
Yeah, definitely. One coach from New Zealand actually said it when we were preparing for the world champs. And then he told us 2013 that, hey, don't you think you should let some of this anger go? Mm-hmm. And we just told him no. 2014, when I won my Commonwealth Games medal, he then told me, man, I see what makes you guys great, and this is part of what makes you great, so don't ever lose it. He changed his mind. He completely changed his mind on it.
Hey, it's off in the way. And then, I mean, after 2014, something which is still stands out to me now, like when we look at your performances, is your 59:47 in 2015. And this is pre-Super Shoes. You know, so we just want to talk about a little bit about the training you were doing going into that. And interestingly, you mentioned a move to Ethiopia. Why did you want to move to Ethiopia over Kenya, and kind of how did that performance come about, basically, and how you were training at the time in order to run that?
So at the end of the season 2013, like, I was still based in Ethiopia, but I would always travel to Kenya just for training blocks.
Okay.
At the end of 2013, we decided, I decided that, okay, I'm training always alone here in Ethiopia. Why don't I join a group? And there was a friend of mine who suggested this particular group. And the coach was super friendly, good English, Gameru Dedefo, and he was the coach for Gianni Di Madonna, the marathoner himself, now management.
Mm-hmm.
And I would join these guys who were running like 204, 205 and winning Dubai and things like that. And it was my first year doing like real marathon training, but the coach was like, kind of like, okay, let's see you get smashed today, Mzungu. It's your first training with the group. And I actually held my own. And he was kind of impressed. He gave me all the kudos. But yeah, he was like, oh, wow. Keep coming. And I did. So I ran my 2013 Ekiden 10K lap.
Mm.
And I ended up running 28:04,
wow,
national record at the time, and completely solo. As you know, the Ekiden's a run.
Mm.
So again, it was showing that, you've got something good on the road and you've got something good with these guys and the endurance factor. But one thing I noticed is I was never finishing the workouts completely unless it was like a medium workout.
Right.
And then the 2014 track season came. I went through that season, and there's a great, great story behind that season as well. But we'll need to keep that one for another time. And maybe you guys do if people, like your followers, want to hear that 2014 season, we'll do another pod later.
Oh, they will.
So the difference when I came from that track season was now that I could finish the sessions in front with the guys who were running 204.
Right.
And so it was like my body had adjusted to the type of training. And I was like, put me in a half marathon. I decided to change management as well, because after my great track season, I had no contract, kind of struggling as a track runner. And the coach asked me, have you ever thought about changing manager? And I was like, ah, interesting. He's like, yeah, Johnny's coming to Kenya. I mean, he's coming to Ethiopia soon. So if you want to talk to him, we can arrange. I changed management. Within 10 minutes talking to Johnny, he said, give me 24 hours and I'll have a contract for you. Wow. And it was the next day he said, Adidas is offering this much.
Wow.
For the first time in my life, I wasn't broke.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, great. Okay. And then Johnny asked me, like, so what event would you like to run? Like, we can look for some races. Like, and Gameru said, let's get him a half marathon. And he knew me as a 1500 and a 5K track guy. Mm. He said, what makes you think you can run a half? Like, what time do you think he can run? And I was like, well, I think I can run under 1 hour.
Wow.
with confidence, looking him in the eyes. And then he looked at the coach and he's like, yeah, this guy, he will run under 60. And Johnny, he couldn't believe it. He kind of laughed it off. And I said, man, try to get me into New Delhi. It's a fast race. It was November.
Mm.
And I was super ready. They basically just denied me. They said, no, we're looking for 59 half marathoners only.
Yeah.
No chance. Going on a few weeks later, I was out of shape and I was overtrained.
Mm.
Went to Kenya for the new year, like to have Christmas in a few weeks, see my brother. And then Johnny called me up like about 2 weeks before, 2 weeks before the New Year's Eve. And he's like, hey, would you like to run in my race in Italy? 10K New Year's Eve Bolzano Classic. And I thought, oh shit, I'm not in shape. But yeah, put me in, because he was offering me a $3,000 appearance fee. And I'd never seen money like this ever on the track. And I was like, yeah, I need money. Okay. Mm. I started training and my shape returned very quickly. I ended up being in the sprint finish with Amana Mirga and Mukhtar Driss.
Wow.
And I was like, okay. After the race, Johnny told me, hey, we have a half marathon for you, 1st of February, but you only have 4 weeks. Will you be ready? And I said, shit. Yeah, put me in. You know, I believe in taking opportunities given to you, because then at least you'll see. You know, if you don't take that chance, you'll never see if you'll make it or not.
Mm.
And I flew back to Ethiopia because I knew I have to join my group. I have to train with my boys. I did 3 weeks of amazing training, 1 week of taper, went out to Marugame in Japan and smashed it.
And then,
you know, to believe in yourself and to know that you can do something, but actually to get it done on the day,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it was like just one of the highlights of my life.
Mm. Yeah. Do you know what is just crazy to me is the fact that when you're in Kenya and Ethiopia is you keep talking about these management companies and you literally can't race unless these guys find you a race. So it is crucial to find the right management, isn't it?
There's so many things, politics and management just lead up and eat away at your career. Mm. 2014 was, people would say it's your best track year of your life, but also it's one of the most devastating years on the track for me of my life.
Right.
Because I believe I could have done so much more.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I got put in B races.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't entered in a race until like the evening after a hard track session, and they throw me in a diamond league less than 24 hours time.
Yeah.
And it raised question marks. Like, I should have been like at least a 1255, 1252 guy or something. Yeah. And 5,000. I think your followers are going to want to hear about 2014 on the next show.
Well, we can cover it now, mate. Or is it a long story?
Man, I could go through it now.
Yeah, go through it now for us. Yeah.
Man, I'll kind of kick it off from the beginning, because I became the first non-Kenyan to win a race in Kenya. I was training amazing with my group that I'd created. Mm-hmm. And I had so much respect as an athlete around the place that with my knowledge, that I even picked up athletes like Augustine Chogi, who is a 1250 guy, to come and train with me on my program. Like, I had Edwin Kipyego, a 59 half guy, and a 2710 guy. I had world junior champions joining me, and I was leading this group, and we were running good track sessions. But as we do every year, we pack up the party bus and we go off to an Athletics Kenya meet somewhere in the country. Dirt tracks, good racing, and some fun. No miles that year. but stayed the night in Momius. The next day I raced the 5,000, and we'd planned in our group that I will run the 5,000 and the 1500 for training purposes. So ended up running the 5,000 and I ran 13:46. I told myself before the race that don't make any moves before a mile to go. Don't make any moves. But some guys just started surging off the front with like 8 laps to go. And I closed the gap and started just going around them, and I thought, well, this feels too easy, just so let me drift to the front here. And as soon as I drifted to the front, I started drifting off the front of them, and I was like, oh shit, I'm not gonna stop because this feels too easy for me, let me just keep going. And I ended up opening a gap of something like 60 meters on second place. They thought I was just gonna blow and maybe I'd come back, man, but I kicked that last lap like hell. I won by something like 60 meters, and I won the entire 5,000. The 1500 was meant to be in the evening, and I was on my warm down from the 5,000, and my guys came running out, hey Zane, the 1500's on. Okay, another opportunity to take. So I took it. I just laced up my spikes, ran down onto the track. I got into heat. I was given the option of heat 2 and heat 3. And I saw heat 2, I had unfinished business with a 3:28 guy, Haron Keitane. He sat on me in 2012, the whole race when I ran 3:41. And then he kicked me down the last 100 meters. Right. And he was a 3:28 guy at the time, and I was a 3:41 guy. So I felt like, okay, unfinished business with this guy, heat 2. Immediately when the gun went, I regretted my decision to start the race. My legs were heavy. I was out the back door. I was in last place.
Yeah.
Last place for the first lap before I started passing people. I was considering to drop out, and I was like, no, just do another lap, just another lap. I got to 800 to go, and I told myself, hey, 600 meters to go is just up there, keep going. And when I got to 500 to go, I realized that there's no one else in front of me except for 3 leaders, and now they're like 20 meters away from me. And I closed the gap at the bell. And Haron Keitane was leading. I got a gap up the inside. Hey, guys. Sorry, I just got a phone call. So you can hear me still?
Yeah, you're good. Yeah.
So I got a gap up the inside, 300 meters to go. And oh, my God. Oh, man, people just don't stop in Kenya. If they call you once, they're calling again. So I started my kick 200 to go, and we went 1-1, like all the way around that bend into the straight. The two guys behind us ended up passing us like 20 meters to go, but I ended up getting third place, 3:43, about 20 minutes after a 13:46 dirt track at altitude. So I thought, holy shit, I'm ready to go this season. It's going to be a good year.
Is it all about where you finish in Kenya? That's what I kind of still like. You know, when I read things and when I see things about Kenyan races, they're not too ever bothered about the time, but it's where you place, because they know that just because of the depth and the level of Kenyan running, if you place in that top three or win a race, you must be in serious shape.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think it all adds to confidence. You know, when you see good times in training or just good feeling in training, then a lot of it comes down to head game. And normally when my body's in shape and I get some positive result, I'm ready to go like very quickly. So this race, it led me on to training like very hard. I did some of the best track session and fartlek sessions I've done in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And I was entered into Shanghai. Went to Shanghai not feeling as good, and I was completely overtrained. I ran like 13:30 something, and I was devastated, completely devastated. But I knew that I'd overtrained. I knew I'd cooked it too hard. I went back to Kenya for a few weeks. Then I went to Oslo, and I went to a 3000 on Strava, and I ended up running really shit as well. And I thought I'd just finished my year right there. I flew out to St. Moritz, and I started training alone and just finding my groove again. And I actually started seeing really positive signs that I'm coming back in training. And I went to, so it was time to test the legs again in a race before Commonwealths. I flew out to Cork in Ireland. I ran 3,000 there, where pacemaker went 800 meters, and I ended up doing the rest, but I ran a 7:41. And I felt I felt really good. Like there was a lot left there. I think 3 days later, I ran in Dublin a 3:53 mile. And again, feeling like a lot left was there. Just tactical error stopped me from running 3:50, perhaps a 3:49 mile with Will Lear. You know, tactical errors. But after that, I said to my management, put me in a 5,000. I'm ready to have a crack at sub 13 here in Houston, Belgium. And the meet director put me into the B race. I didn't go. I ended up not going. I said, no way, that's not me. I want to run 12:50 something here. I'm ready to go. And he put me in the B. So I went straight to Commonwealths after that, and around 13:16 for the bronze, and in a tactical race. So I knew I was there. I knew I was ready for something good, and I just kept my training going. I felt amazing for 2 days after the race, and on the third day after the race, I felt awful, and it just turned out to be the day of the 1500 heats.
Yeah.
So I ran terrible in the 1500. I missed the final, but in a way I was okay with it, because I knew that, this happens, ups and downs in track. You'll feel good. You'll feel bad. I went back to Belgium after the race. And we stayed in an altitude house there We're in Leuven. It's a small city outside Brussels. And I loved that because I could get the best out of myself at sea level. I could get the quality in and really, really high quality that I wasn't used to getting. So I was building my confidence at the same time.
Mm.
I went out and did one of these sessions, 5x800. The slowest was 201 and the fastest was 157. And they all had a minute to a minute 10 seconds rest in between.
Mm.
And then I followed with 5x300 and 43:41 type of thing.
Mm.
And I came back home to get a phone call from the management saying, hey, do you want to run Stockholm Diamond League? And I was like, isn't that like the day after tomorrow?
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, it is. And I'd been waiting for like almost a month to hear something like, get me in Zurich, Brussels, Stockholm, any of these. And I just lost it. I was like, guys, do you know what I've just done?
Mm.
Like, do you know that I'm in the shape of my life and that you've just screwed me?
Mm.
Because I'm not American. I don't just go and do strides and jogging when I'm in Europe. I actually train. And I said, put me in the race, put me in. I ended up going there and I was out right behind the pacemakers. Mm. It was Galen Rupp and then me. We went through 3K in 7:43.
Wow.
I was feeling really good until about a lap later. And I ran my last mile very slow. I ran like 13:26, I believe it was, and absolutely devastated. I think I went something like 4 or 5 days later, I went to Birmingham and I got second in the Diamond League mile record to Mo Farah. I think it was another 5 days later, I raced in Berlin. I ran 13:13. I got fifth place. I was very tired, very exhausted from travel, from training, and I'd never really recovered from that session. And, you know, when you travel, you can't recover so well because you're constantly under stress. But I went back to Belgium, and they told me, hey, do you want to run in Rieti 3,000 or 1,500? And this was the first race that I actually knew that I had coming up with 2 weeks to go.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, put me in 1,500. I haven't done a good one all year. So it was my second 1,500 of the year. I had pretty good confidence because of one of the sessions I'd done. It's one of the sessions of my life in my 1,500 life, I guess. It was two sets of 4x400 with 40-second recoveries between reps and 2 minutes between sets. I did a 30-minute tempo warm-up, somewhere like 3:10 to 3:00. Then I came in and I was like, okay, you need to run race pace, which is like 57s. I ran between 54 and 57, and then the second set was exactly the same, 54 to 57. Will Lear showed up and told me it was one of the most mental sessions he's ever heard of, and he didn't believe that I'd done it. When I went to Rieti and I ran 3:34:19, I was again really disappointed by it.
Yeah,
because I got left in the back straight. I was boxed in a little bit, and I had to kick past a Moroccan and David Torrance who had blown up. And I closed on the lead Africans in the last 150. I ended up almost beating. I beat Augustine Chogi. I almost beat Mekonnen, who was a power at the time, but I was still disappointed by it, and. I had Will Lear coming over to me again saying like, why are you fucking disappointed? Because you're faster than me. But, you know, it's all coming down to, again, just that one was a tactical error on my behalf. I went after that. I flew straight to the Continental Cup where I ran the 5,000 and I got second place. And I closed my year on the track. And I think I closed my track career, actually. The only time I ever raced after that was World Championships and Olympics.
So what's fascinating is, like you said, being an elite athlete, that is real in the sense that in the summer, you just don't know when you're racing most of the time, because these meets can take so long to finalize the entries, can't they? And that is one of the frustration from fans as well. We don't know start lists before, like, you know, 2 or 3 days out. The fans doesn't even know his racing, let alone for the athletes. It must be terrible.
Yeah.
It's a constant battle.
It depends who you are as well. Like,
yeah,
some of the American athletes, like the 5K guys, they knew their race schedule. They knew they were in Stockholm, Brussels, Zurich. Mm. And they knew it like 2 or 3 months before.
Yeah, yeah, when they came out.
And then I was saying, like, I'm a Commonwealth medalist.
Yeah.
I've run like good times this year. Put me in.
Mm.
And they're just like, oh, you're not American. That's all they told me, which actually spurred on that change at the end of the year when the coach was like, have you ever considered changing management?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was broke, no contract, and this guy could get me a contract.
Mm.
So all positive in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. I mean, let's just move forward a little bit. And I guess we want to know kind of how Kenya's changed over the past few years and where you're at now.
Yeah, so life for me has changed a lot. I'm good. I live in a house now, not a concrete cell. I have a Ford Ranger, so I have a pickup truck. I can get around. My training team or my guys, they roll with me to join other big groups.
Mm.
I'm kind of fishing around for which groups to join now, but there's always like 2 or 3 options I can go to. I don't want to just be captain of the ship and run my own team anymore, because then I don't have the challenge and I like to sometimes train with better athletes than myself, because although I'll let them go and I'll sometimes be smart, I still like to see where I'm at. Mm. I think E10 is blowing up into being a huge tourism place, and there's a lot of Mzungu out here all the time, all times of the year. The peak season is normally from December through to April.
Right.
And I kind of try to avoid the whole thing. In a way, it gives a lot of money to the county for the tourism industry, and they didn't do anything good with that money. They've put cheap mud and rocks all over the roads, and they were given that money to actually lay good mud and roll it so the roads would stay perfect all times of the year.
Yeah.
But instead, now we've got all-weather roads with rocks sticking out of them. And
right, yeah.
We also were promised a running track because they turned Kamarine, one of the best dirt tracks I've ever run on in my life, and also an icon for, like, E10. They destroyed it to create a tartan track there, and they've just made a stadium, and the track is nowhere near finished. So E10, if you're coming out, there's a few tracks in Eldoret. There's a tartan track, Kipchoge now. There's a track down in Tambach, dirt track. There's Lorna's High Altitude Training Centre track, which no one uses. You have to pay for. Mm. The groups in E10 are always there and in numbers. There's never a time where you'll have no one to run with, which is, I think, is the best, one of the best aspects of being here. You'll always have company on the roads and you'll always have motivation.
It's an interesting point. Like, do you see the big icons as much anymore? Like you say, you kind of keep your head low and try to avoid that peak season. We know Kipchoge kind of keeps himself to himself now because he's almost too big. As before, obviously, when you rocked up in 06, you just bumped into Shaheen and he kind of took you under his wing. Like, would you get that anymore?
You do. Depends on the athlete.
Okay.
You do. You're just like running maybe through the forest, and you'll just bump into Bridget Koske running along or something. So you do see all the big names still out there. They're pretty humble if you get them in person, but it's just hard to get them. You know, you need to know where to be, the right times. And I was building my own running camp in the mountains recently last year. It's all finished now. It's not for that tourism boom. It's just for myself and my guys when we want to get away to have less oxygen from here.
How high is it?
It's the highest running camp in the world, I believe. There's one for Dr. Rose at 3,000 meters altitude. And that's in Cap Sait. That's about 15 kilometers away from where mine is. Mine's at 3,124 meters.
Jesus, man.
I would prove me wrong. Someone out there, you know, anywhere higher, but I've wrote it on the wall. World's highest altitude camp.
I was gonna say that's 10,000 feet for us like British people. Yeah, it's 10,000 feet. Wow.
Man, I mean, the first 1 or 2 weeks up there, you suffer. Even I suffer. First time I was up there, I didn't sleep so good, but it was also my guys. We didn't sleep so good. Mm. Now, whenever I go up there, I just have crazy dreams.
Wow. Look, you've been there a long time now. I don't know if this is a question we even need to ask, but do you ever have any plans of just leaving and kind of going back to your Western civilization, if you like?
Yeah, I do. definitely. Like, after running, I'll definitely be hanging out less and less here.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't decided where that will be yet. I'm 50-50 between a few places, maybe the US, maybe Australia. I'm kind of going to bank on the fact that I can do something for ASICS after my career, mm-hmm. and wherever they kind of want me to be, or wherever they think I could be a big impact. I have my own ideas of starting running clubs and kind of like, you know, like night run clubs, you know, the Nike did something similar. And wherever that could be, like if it would be Los Angeles, or if it could be Gold Coast or Perth or who knows where. Building my own house now here in E10, land on the escarpment. So if people have been to E10, they'll know the view is amazing. So 100 times better view than Korea view. Got to know the landscape, but I got lucky. So at least for my running career, I will be using this place for training camps in the years to come if I'm based less and less here. But to answer the question, just a simple yes. I won't be here forever.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what are the plans then? What are kind of, because obviously you have got more of your running career left, like what are the main goals you still want to do in your career?
So right now, a lot of it lays with the marathon. Track, unfortunately, I think I will never come back. There's not enough motivation there, and there's a lot of potential risk involved for less reward. I do want to run a very fast marathon, but for now, it's going to wait. I have a few options early next year to run a marathon. I'd like to go and run fast, but not crazy fast, but more so for position. I want to win a marathon somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't say where yet. And then probably later on in the year, attack a really fast one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the immediate future. I haven't decided yet if I'll run Commonwealth Games or World Champs. I prefer Commonwealths because it still means a lot in New Zealand. But that all depends on, again, risk and reward. I'm yet to hear what the government will offer us if we do bring a gold medal, because I could run a marathon major and end up way more financially better off. Yeah. And also I feel deeper in myself, like I've done something good for myself.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, so basically you're waiting to hear what your governing body would do for you if you did bring some silverware home from the Commonwealth Games. What recognition did you get after Glasgow?
And we had a system in New Zealand where you get some money, like support every month. Wow. After you win a medal.
Wow.
So you get a little bit of support, and that was great for me because,
yeah,
I mean, I needed that. I was really broke at the time being a track runner. So it was the first sign of money from the track, but definitely nowhere near what I get on the roads.
No. No.
Yeah.
I mean, look. I was going to say we've covered a whole heap, mate, and it's been an absolute awesome chat. I guess we just want to finish on, you're obviously sponsored by ASICS at the moment. You know, let's boast about their shoes, mate. You know, sell their shoes to us. Which ones do you love? Which ones do you run in every day?
Oh, yeah. So I've changed management again to Tom Broadbent. He's in the UK. More of a personal connection as well, like friendships, so we could – I feel good about staying with that company until the end of my career.
Mm-hmm.
And ASICS, again, is just like a great company. They support me as an athlete and a human, you know. They're not ruthless like the other companies where they just cut you if you don't perform or you don't race well or you have an injury. Mm-hmm. The shoes I've been using lately, which I really like, I like the Cumulus. They're an all-round shoe. You can just wear them anywhere in the forest,
okay.
Dirt roads, tarmac. It's a nice enough ride. It's soft, but not too soft. Dyna Blast. It's the lower cut version of the Nova Blast.
Yeah.
I think Nova is a little too high, but it's everyone's choice. So I like the Dyna Blast for fast or long runs, workouts, when I don't need to wear the race shoes. And then I've been playing around, actually. Everyone knows I race with the Metaspeed Sky, but I've been playing around with the new prototypes. So we've been started work on those shoes like early this year. So I've been training my really hard stuff with the new shoes for what will be released next year, I think in February or March.
Okay. Do you know the name? Oh, they haven't got a name yet.
Yeah.
I think I've seen a few leaks. They do.
Yeah, look they good. Look good. They look good.
Yeah. Oh man, I think some of the guys are actually racing with the prototypes now. Some races like white. They're completely white.
Yeah, the white ones. Branding on them.
Mm. Yeah. So you've seen them.
Yeah, we've seen it. We were just trying to get the inside scoop.
Man, I will off the podcast.
Love it. Anyway, I think thank you so much for coming on. It's been brilliant to chat to you. And thank you for sharing all your stories. I'm sure our listeners will love it.
Yeah, I hope I didn't talk too much, but some of these stories you need to talk it out, and I hope everyone listening just enjoys it.
Oh mate, I'm sure they will. You're an absolute fascinating character, and you're probably going to inspire a few people just to make that leap to Kenya, mate.
Thanks for listening, guys. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. As always, if you did, please leave us a rating and review, as it really helps us out. Look, you heard there what ASICS shoes Zane's using in his rotation. If you want to get any of those, they're available on sportsshoes.com. You can use code SUNDAYPLOD10, all in capitals, to get 10% off and free delivery. That's code SUNDAYPLOD10. See you next week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.